So experience design in a broad view. So I'm going to present why does experience design even exist? We are talking about experience. We encounter this acronym UX, user experience. That's what it means. But it actually means very literal. People use this term a lot, and this acronym more than actually the full term. User experience, because people are talking about something that's not yet very clear to anyone. It's quite a new challenge for design, for marketing, and for entrepreneurship and business. And people, instead of really thinking thoroughly about this thing, people are just trying to do stuff and see the results. And therefore, they use this acronym just to start doing something about it, without thinking much. UX. So what do you do for your living? I am a UX. What is a UX? Well, we just build up some digital interfaces and wireframes and flowcharts. And that's not what I mean, what I want to build up as a notion of experience design here. I really want to go much further from UX, but before we do that, we have to give a step back and see how does UX even became relevant? Why people are talking about user experience? If you Google images for user experience, you will see a lot of models, diagrams like these ones. And that's definitely what I don't want you to think that user experience is. So to me, this is not user experience. These are design models or process models. Like, these are recipes for you to create mostly digital artifacts. User experience, therefore, is not a diagram. And I'm not going to start describing this field and the problematics of it from a diagram, because a diagram is an abstract representation of something that we are talking about something very concrete. When you talk about experience, we are talking about something that people have gone through in their lives. And they really have this bodily memory of it. And if you say, it was like that, or like this, and you use words to describe it, you might find inappropriate, reductionist. You're not really telling what it was. And imagine with a diagram. A diagram is a very abstract way of describing experience. So first of all, let's try to remind ourselves our bodily experiences and build up the idea of experience design from that. So user experience is just a moment in our everyday lives. It's just like any other experience we have. So while you are in a computer having a user experience, people are cooking, people are talking, people are drinking. They are also having experiences. You may not call them user experiences because it's difficult to say that a person cooking is a user. He's more like a cook. But it is an experience, right? Some experiences are more meaningful than other experiences. And you might recall them and give more value to them in your life. For example, first time you learned to surf, when you met a person that you really loved after a long time of waiting. These experiences, they are built by the people themselves. It's not just the artifacts that are building them. So you can see here that there are a surfboard, a car here. There are the glasses over there. All these are artifacts that were being designed. But those experiences that people are enjoying were not created by those artifacts. They were created by the people themselves. And fortuitously, or by a situation that was not planned and made sometimes by the designers of these artifacts, those artifacts played a role in the experience. So, instead of just talking about user experiences and looking at the relationship between the artifact and the person who is using the artifact, in the moment that the person is using and ignoring everything else, instead, I propose you to think about experiences in general and not just experience when you're using stuff or using design artifacts. I really want you to understand many kinds of experience, not just user experiences. And that's going to be key to design meaningful experiences. So let's dig into some concepts that are drawn from psychology, education, anthropology. I'm just combining a bunch of interesting knowledge in a very simplified way. If you want to go deep into that, I can point you to some bookish references for you to understand the philosophical basis of this. But anyway, you will definitely have also a bodily experience to relate when I'm talking about those things. You remember situations. So, first of all, experiences rises from our senses in contact with the world. So experiences do not come from the artifact. It's not produced by the design itself. It's produced by the contact of our senses with the artifact. And that means that sometimes our senses are different and the experience will be different too. The way I perceive things, the way I see things, the way I hear, listen to things is different than the way you do. And sometimes you have a completely different culture because of that. For example, Kylie told us a lot about the death culture, right? It's not just people are not just having a hearing impairment. It's actually they have a whole worldview different because their senses are different than us. So imagine that people have diverse senses and they have diverse experiences. From that, you can already imply. We also reflect on those senses. It's not just a direct stimulation that affect our experiences. It's actually a mediated experience. We reflect on everything that comes through our senses. We relate back to other experiences. That means the variety and the diversity of experiences increases a lot. And it's not just a direct relationship that everybody will have the same experience from this chair. Because the senses are different and the reflections are different. So everybody, every person will make sense differently, even though they are going through the same social experience. For example, Curitiba's Carnival. Have anyone already went through one of these blocos? No? No, you haven't tried? You tried?
Yeah. It was the, how do you say, Parada de Bonecos.
All right. And did you like it? No, not much, right? But some people are really excited about Curitiba's Carnival. Look at these people in the picture. They are really excited. So, yeah, those people like it. But most of people in Curitiba are not really excited about Carnival. Actually, Curitiba was considered in the past the capital of the people that hated Carnival. So if you didn't want to have a noisy place to stay during Carnival time, you would come to Curitiba. But unfortunately, some people, well, unfortunately for us, because I don't like so much this noise Carnival, but I have to admit that the city is big enough for having those people too, right? So last year's people start to gather around in Curitiba and do real Carnival, noisy Carnival. So people get a different meaning out of the same experiences. And the context is really important for meaning. Context is a term coming from linguistics. That means everything that is around a text. So context really exists as a term to understand how meaning arises from a text. So a text is not read only by its text. A text is also read by what is in between the lines. And also, in the paper itself, or in the place where you are reading, all this contributes to the meaning you give to text. And that's what that's why we call attention. And you have this term, context, that we borrow from linguistics and uses a lot in design. And in this example, I'm just showing the differences of enjoying carnival on the streets in a bloco and enjoying carnival in the parade, which I think it's even more boring. But some people might get excited. And this last year, they moved to Marechal Deodoro Street, which is a more central place. Yeah, before, there were just a very handful of people watching the parade at, what is the name of the street? Cândido de Abreu. My goodness, that was pitiful. Now it's a little bit cozier because Marechal Deodoro, I think it's smaller, doesn't give that sense of emptiness that Cândido de Abreu brings about. So you already seen how context changed everything for this party. And also, it depends on your experience and your willingness to go there and see. For example, if you are if you live in Marechal Deodoro and there are some residential buildings over here and you don't like carnival, you'll be really willing to go out at home from home at this time of the year, right? And those experiences that are meaningful to you, they most likely will become knowledge for you. You will remember those experiences. They will become memorable. And this is part. This is very important why you are a child. Because a child has some difficulties on understanding abstract concepts. The child is typically not yet trained well to live in a world of meanings that is abstracted from our direct experience, like a virtual world that we as adults live. For example, I'm right now talking about a lot of things that are not likely present to you. I'm making those things and those concepts present to you through my words and through the images on these slides. And you can perfectly relate to that. But the person that is a child who is still learning how to operate in this a meaningful world, the child can learn much better through direct bodily experiences. And she will build up knowledge on top of that. And the possibility, the capability of abstracting out will grow from these bodily experiences. And memory is the function of the mind that organizes all these bodily experiences and relates them to other previous experiences and generates what we call knowledge. And knowledge is basically a bunch of organized experience that we can relate and uses when it's appropriate. But there is another side to memory that I'm going to talk about later on. So first of all, what is the medium of memory and perception? It is language. Language is the basis of how we codify our experiences in a way that we can understand and in a way that other people can also understand. And as we saw also from the deaf studies, the language is also the basis for development of thought and intelligence. And if you are not able to develop language at a certain age, you might have intellectual difficulties in your life, right? So it's very important, and that's why children are always talking or at least listening to other people in the languages that they are able to understand. As we saw, also there are other languages than the spoken language, right? Like the Libras in Brazil and other countries, something similar for deaf people. Imagination is the other side of memory. Actually, imagination can be understood as a kind of poetic memory. You are remembering something that did not happen. You are remembering something that may happen in the future. So while you are dreaming, your imagination is going wild. And you are creating new experiences for yourself, especially experiences that you are not able to have directly, bodily, in a bodily way. But sometimes, as a child, you might engage into play in children's games that allows you to experience, and even a bodily way, somehow poorer than the real experience that you want to have, but at least something that helps you to understand how is like to drive a car. Then you jump into a cardboard car, and then you drive as if, and you do all the gestures as if you were driving. And then you understand driving, then you have some knowledge from it, although in a kind of poorer version of it. And we also do that as adults. For example, you're doing this in this class, somehow you will have experiences that are similar to what you get in industry or you get in other situations in your life where you will use the methods and the concepts you are conveying through this class. But this class is not real life. You will not lose your job if you do something wrong. You are here allowed to somehow get things wrong and recover and understand from that. And the most important thing you will learn is that the role of design in learning from experiences. So what is design? There are multiple definitions of design, and I'm going to present a new definition for you. But let's make it simple now. Design just materializes imagination. So if someone's think about why not having a chair that crosses legs, like the people that sit in the chair, and then the designer really makes a chair that crosses legs, and you look at that, and you think about, wow, that why haven't anyone done this before? It's because nobody had believed so much in their imagination. I'm sure that some people might have had this idea before, but the designer is just a person who tries to show that imagination is also a real thing. It's not just something to be ignored, and it's a very important part of building experiences. So when we apply design for experiences, we'll build up and we stimulate imagination all the time. And companies are increasingly turning to design when facing the challenge to stage experiences. So there is a new paradigm in marketing, which is called experience economy. It's actually not that new. This was posed by Joseph Pine and Gilmore in 1990s. They wrote this book. It's a very influential book in marketing, but mostly also in design. Most designers don't know this book, The Experience Economy, but I really recommend you if you want to understand the broad picture where experiences I fit in. And what they describe in the book, the main concept, is the progression of economic value. They say that in the beginning of capitalism was focused on commodities. And commodities, they had a low market value and a low differentiation. They were just basically the same commodity all over the world. And their prices were also the same all over the world, because coffee in one country will be almost the same, produced in the same way as if in other countries. Nowadays, we have gourmetized, né? Gourmetizado, né? Coffee, café gourmetizado. So this coffee that we are now buying, the raw coffee, comes from a different place. It was bred in a different way. And there's a bunch of other kinds of discourses and meanings ascribed to this commodity that tries to elevate it, the price, and elevates the value. But there's a limit. What actually really makes a difference is that if you transform this coffee into a product, a fully fledged product, and that it has a brand, it has all the information about its origin, and it has a particular kind of taste, for example. But this will not be as valuable as actually having the coffee served to you with a proper taste, with sugar or not sugar, in the place that where you can sit and enjoy the coffee. And that's a service. Then you have the waiter bring your coffee to you, asking how do you prefer it and so on. So this is a service. But if you customize the service to people and they really want to understand their needs, you have an experience like Starbucks. This is maybe not the best example so far. Starbucks, I wouldn't say it's the best customized experience, but they definitely did that in a large scale. So they can really give you a sense, a feeling, like the doggery example we saw in the beginning of this class, that you are having an experience and not just having coffee. So you enter a different place that doesn't look like the regular cafeteria or the regular lanchonete or padaria where we typically get coffee here in Brazil. You feel like you're entering another place. And while you are there, people ask about your name. They write their name on the cup. That's such a trick, such a simple trick that looks like it's customized to you. But the coffee is the same. It's not just made for you, right? But anyhow, they put out some effort and people pay more for that. So people like Starbucks.
Do we have Starbucks in Brazil?
Yes, we do.
In São Paulo. Not Curitiba though, right?
Curitiba doesn't have Starbucks any longer?
No.
Only that's my question. Only São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro.
Really?
Right. Yep. Rio.
Forbidden?
Yeah.
I remember going to a Starbucks some years ago, but...
Yes, because they want to give value to coffee from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, something like this.
My gosh.
As actually said, that Curitiba is one of the most difficult cities to please in this way. Like, if it works here, they implement it somewhere.
Yeah, that's a common thought. Well, anyhow, I remember going to a Starbucks in... what's the name? In Barigui Shopping. I remember that, but it was a long time ago, maybe.
Yeah, I think it closed.
Yeah, it closed, definitely. Well, we have a lot of good coffee shops in Curitiba, as we saw in last class, right? Mm-hmm. We might not need.
Yeah, that's my point. I was going to make a connection to our going to the coffee shop exercise. Now, if you go to Starbucks, and Professor Frederick just told us the context is very important. And Starbucks was designed for the average American coffee context, where they leave the house without eating or drinking anything. They go there, grab the coffee to go, and take the coffee. We, as Brazilians, would like more the other way. We like to sit and calmly drink the coffee.
Yeah, but I would say that Starbucks really tried to change the behavior of American people because they offer like this nice, comfortable space to stay, right?
Wi-Fi.
But they would stay there because of their Wi-Fi. Because I think it was one of the first public space to offer Wi-Fis, open Wi-Fi, right?
Uh-huh.
It was Starbucks.
And then people went there just to get the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
So different cultures have different ways of. And I don't like Starbucks because just like any restaurant in America, I feel like they want me to get the food and get out of there. And that's one reason, for instance, the reason why Pizza Hut was not a success here in Brazil. Because to go out to eat pizza for us is an experience. We bring friends, we sit down.
And we stay long.
We stay long, we talk.
But I mean, they are changing that too.
I know, they have to
change. When I was a kid, I think, I don't know how old I was, but... Pizza Hut actually had those huge plushies. I don't know if you guys went to that time. They had like, I don't know, a 2 meter tall bear plushie in each table. And I was a kid, so that was awesome.
Cool.
I just was like, stand there.
Petting.
Yeah, petting it. And that made the experience better. I think they were trying to make people like stay longer, especially if they had kids.
Yeah.
Because usually people with kids, they're like, let's just have something very quickly before the kids start embarrassing us or something. I mean,
context is everything, yeah.
Context is everything.
All right. So, as you can see, the progression of economic value is not the same in all countries because context plays a big role. But there is a common process of increasing the value and decreasing the value, which is happens in all the places. All the offerings, be that a commodity, a product, a service, or an experience, is subjected to customization, can be customized, but it will inevitably be commoditized or commodified. That means if I offer a customized version of coffee with a special service, another competitor might offer that for half of the price. And once it does and offer somehow a similar experience than what I was offering, then this experience turns into a product because you can buy that experience anywhere else. It does not have the same uniqueness that had in the beginning. For example, at Catholic University, now they just opened last month, a fake version of Starbucks that has another name and it's very small, but it has the same look and feel and also similar beverages. I enjoy the beverages, but I wouldn't pay the same price of Starbucks for something that does not really offer the whole thing. It's just a place where you can order, but you cannot sit anywhere. Like, it's not the full experience. But anyhow, what they are showing is that Starbucks is already a product, not any longer such a unique experience. So this changes of this value changes is happening all the time. And with design, we hopefully contribute to increasing the value through customization, which is one way how design can contribute. Digital channels, they are a key to mass customization. They really allow you to customize services and reach a global audience with personalized communication and personalized attention. If you don't have digital channel, you cannot do that with a regular service. That depends on face-to-face human contact. Digital services, you can somehow organize and sometimes control what humans do to other humans through that meme. You can have much more control than what you get from physical space design, which is already used to control people. But with digital design, with digital infrastructure, you can do much more than that. And that's probably the reason the rise of digital channels and the decrease in price for investing in this infrastructure is probably the reason why experience design is now becoming a common word, or user experience design. Those companies that are born digital, like they start from a digital infrastructure premise that this will be the way they deliver services, the main way they deliver services, they are really driven by experience economy thinking. And Nubank is an example from Brazil, but there are a bunch of other companies that really start digital and they with the premise of offering the best experience, user experience possible. But what I foresee in the future is that those digitally born companies will also offer physical interactions. And I can see that Nubank in the future will have its own agencies, physical agents where you can, the bank, what's the name? The bank, right? Just physical banks. And then you will go there and have another kind of experience that you can really have in a bodily way. This will happen. Anyhow, another side of this story, which is typically not considered in experience design, is that the user now has to do some part of the work that the company did in the past. So, for example, choosing what's going to be the main drawings, illustrations on your t-shirt. This was done by the company. The company said, these are our seasons. This is the season, and you have to choose among all of these five models. But at Threadless, you can choose 10,000 different illustrations for your t-shirt. And they will print out your illustration after you purchase it. It's not ready-made there waiting for you. And you can also draw your own illustration and submit to Threadless. And maybe other consumers, other users will also purchase your drawing. And you will earn part of this of the royalties for that. Well, this company actually pays the user for the work the user is doing. But most of the companies in the experience economy does not pay or reward or even recognize that the user is also co-creating value. So the user needs to do part of the work that was once done by the companies. And the reason why design is now so important for these companies is that these companies expect designs to help control the user work. So they carefully design things so that the user does not do anything wrong or does not get lost or is not having a bad experience. Well, in the design field, people are talking about and reflecting about those things. Some people have a critical stance over it. For example, in my thesis, I analyze how the design object, the thing that designers design, is moving from a complex entity since the 80s towards an emergent performance, which is a term I coined to put everything that is now commonplace or at least new in the design field under the same umbrella. So an emergent performance is like emotions, informations, interfaces, interactions, experiences, services. And that's a very different kind of design object than in the past design dealt with. Products and graphic products, they were static things. And we deal with this shift, this expansion of the design object in a daily basis here at Industrial Design Department. Because most of the professors and also most of the students, they have this mindset of designing something which is going to be static, something that is bounded, something that is under your control. And that's what the companies still in the industry expect you as a designer to do, to help controlling the user through the products you the company is offering. But the reality, and that's what I'm going to dig into next slides, is that you cannot really control the experience and you cannot really control. This is an uncontrolled design paradigm, which is so different, this difficult to understand. So let me give you an example. In the 30s or 40s, I don't remember now, Dreyfus, a very important designer in the history of design, he was commissioned by Bell Labs to design this 302 model, which became the standard shape for telephones. But what he did, he studied a lot of ergonomics and anthropometrics and how the average user would use that. And he designed a really fitting product for that use. But there's only basically one use for telephones, just calling. But compare that to a Palm VX, the grandfather of your smartphone. You could do a lot of things with a Palm VX. You could read, you could draw, you could take notes. You could even navigate the internet. Can you believe that? Yes, you could not call with the Palm VX. But later versions of Palm had actually phones integrated. And they became smartphones. And what I mean by emergent performance is that you cannot really anticipate and foresee what people will do with your product. Here you can really tell. People will hang on the telephone, dial the number, and talk. And after they are done, they just hang off. Hang up. Yes. So they hang up. And this was a paradigm where the task would be known. But here, you cannot really talk about task because there is no predefined structure for the activity itself. People are just experiencing in their lives, these products are part of their lives. And what can you do as a designer? So this is very hard. But first of all, it's not just a change in your methods. It's a change in your mindset. It's an epistemological shift. In the past, the complex entity, you would design a technical object that put a lot of knowledge into physical structure or cognitive or informational structures. So you basically try to foresee everything that was possible because it was easy to do that. The possibilities were bounded. They were not so big. So you could really encode information into the object. But now, this object is not fixed. This object is changing. That's why I call it performative object. And you cannot encode all the information that's going to go through it that people would experience. So basically, you have to design something which is a little bit diffuse, something vague, something flexible, and shape-changing somehow. Even if you are not able to do that in a physical way, you may do that in a digital way. So you may offer some flexible infrastructure. So basically, what is a performative object? Stating the clearest way I can do now, it's something that does not stay in a particular place or a particular time. It's just happened all over. So what you design when you design an experience is not a physical thing. It's this mixture of physical, cognitive, and social things. And it arises from complexity because there are many things in places, many things that are being considered. But it goes beyond it because it emerges out of the complexity and sometimes surprises you. It is characterized by relational properties such as handling, quality, rhythm, and meaning. Where is handling in this chair, on this table? Where is the handling? The handling is not in the chair, not in the table. The handling is in the relationship where I take the chair or I take the table. Right? So the focus of experience design is on these relationships. That's changed everything in design because design in the past was about the objects and physical objects, bounded objects. Now it's about relational objects or the relation to objects. So it's very difficult to pinpoint and talk about. And I'm not making this harder just to look like I am smarter than you. That's not the point. Or trying to confuse you. It's because this stuff really challenges us designers and researchers.
I just wanted to again make a connection to last class. So performative object is a relational property. And last class we talked about interaction, and there is no such a thing as one interaction provided by this object. As we could see by the examples, there are many interactions. And it depends on you and the context and the time of the day. So if you go to that bus stop and it's not a rush hour, you're going to have one interaction. If you're cold and it's raining, you're going to have a different interaction. And all of those things are going to be what you as a human being experience with the system. And that's going to give you a different experience each time. So what the professor is saying is, sometimes you cannot have control of all the variables. You can only plan for the most important variables, like if it's going to rain, if it's a lot of sun or something like that. So you can see how experience is more than just designing the object. It's just to make a point that professor has been doing, he has been making throughout his presentation, right?
And just to bridge the gap between what we saw last week, which is interactions, and experiences that we are seeing now, experience is like an umbrella term derived from meaning. So after you go through a lot of interactions with the world, you give meaning, or you sometimes you don't have meaning. If you don't have meaning for a lot of interactions, you might not have the sense you had an experience with it. But if you have meaning from different interactions, all those interactions contribute towards some the same meaning, then you feel like you're having an experience. So we are having a discussion on a broader terms this week. But later on we come back to interactions, because interactions is something more tangible that you can actually talk about and design for. But if you don't have this broad perspective, you might design a lot of good interactions on their own that does not contribute to a overall meaningful experience. So in all this vague situation, like with this abstracted design object, designers, they had to have something in common to talk about, something tangible to talk about, something that they would use and refer all the time once they had to take a decision what to do, and do design this way or in that way. And then the user raised as some kind of object. There is a researcher called Johan Redstrom that he said, are we going towards user design? Are we designing the lives of people that uses our products in that such user experience design thing? Are we trying to design the lives of other people? And yeah, I would say so. People are really trying, but they are not being able to, because you cannot really achieve that 100%, but you can achieve some percent. And I think Facebook, for example, is one of the best examples how user experience can change the lives of millions and billions of people. And people might not be aware of that. But I'm not going to... Yes?
I was reading yesterday something about Heidegger from Facebook, where everyone can change the lives. Such a big thing that he has all the power and he controls like a generations, and it's so big that like all the authorities are talking about it and trying to change this, because it's so much power into one monopoly
few hands
and changing so much the meanings of what it is to technology and social stuff. And I think it's very related to this.
The thing that saddens me about this story is that the user experience design professionals mostly do not talk or think or get an interest on that. But they are somehow responsible for this. Because Facebook simply applies some rules of thumb that were developed by this user experience design field in many different cases and situations. So but they are basically having their best user experience designers in that team. And they are using that not to really allow people to develop their own thinking and feelings about the world. They are somehow trying to shape those feelings and meanings out of the world. And then it becomes dangerous, because a few people are doing that, and especially with no transparency. And the people that are raising their hands against Facebook world domination project are not from the user experience design profession. But they should be, because we are basically doing that. We are contributing to that. It's our profession, right? Even if you don't work for Facebook, you should be feel responsible, because it's your profession. If something happens in that similar to that in other fields, in other professional fields, the professional associations would raise up and tell the government to have to write some public policies to prevent that. But we don't have strong professional associations. At least we have some professional associations that does not breed critical thinking. And that's why I'm not directly involved into these associations, because they just want to help you to get a job, to have the latest techniques on the field. But this political part of it, which I find very important, especially now that we have such massive scale cases, they are just silent about. So I'm quite a. Some people would think that I'm just exaggerating things, and in the field of user experience design, many times I'm criticized for raising these kind of hard topics. But anyhow, in my class, I would teach what I think it's right. So I think it's right that we reflect, and I'm sure that Kylie also is on board with me, right?
Totally. I'm from computer science, and I taught the students who went on to be the developers of Facebook, Google, or anything. And I had a big chunk of the classes talking about ethical behavior. Like, if you are hired to design something that's going to influence other people's lives, how do you know what's right and wrong? And from this point of view, yes, technology may be neuter in itself, but its use, it's not neuter. Some people choose for good and some people choose for bad. It's just like you designers are designing something, a brand, to sell something that causes cancer. And a lot of designers design the packets of cigarettes, right? So do you do it? And what are the implications of your doing it? So I totally agree with Professor Frederick, and this is a very good and important discussion to have.
So I don't want to go too much into this ethical discussion, because I don't like discussing ethics as separated from our practice. But you will know now that everything that we select for you on doing, everything we stimulate on doing in the next class, which is practical, they were carefully chosen in order to reflect on ethics while you're doing it. Because this is the departure point from my work and also from Kylie's work. Well, the user, as I said, became the anchor to this fugacious object, this vague thing. So we are basically trying to design users. And there is a move in the technical field and in the design field to consider the user now as an emotional being and not just a rational being of before. In the past, people would consider the task object model that Kylie showed to you. Like, people would approach an object or situation looking for something that they already knew before, and they would act rationally to reach that goal. That's the rational user. But a lot of people now in the field are talking about users that do not know what they want, that don't want to know what they want, they just want to experience something. And that's exactly what you do at Facebook. You open Facebook without any goal. You just want to somehow fill up a break in your time or get distracted in a boring class. I hope not in this one. But on Facebook, you're not really reaching any goal. You're not being rational. Anytime you flip through Facebook, you are being bombarded by emotions. That's what Facebook does to you. It's an emotional management thing. So you're basically managing your own emotions through Facebook. So if you feel bored, you get a little less bored. You see something that might amaze you, and you don't know what. And that's precisely why you are always checking Facebook, because there is a hope of surprise. But the rate of surprise in Facebook is really lowering, at least for myself. My feed is really getting to some kind of a really recognized patterns, especially after these uproar of political discussions in the social media since last year. People are really talking about the same things over and over. Bolsonaro this, Bolsonaro that, and Haddad this, Haddad that, and Lula and blah blah blah, Moro. But they are the same people and the same arguments all over again. It's really boring nowadays, at least for me. But that might be because I'm doing this to myself. Because I am liking things in the same way and not liking things in the same way as I did last year. I'm not changing my own perspectives over it. That's why I'm not getting surprised. So Facebook is creating this kind of machine that we stimulate ourselves. But we think we are doing that through our own means and through our own control if we reflect on it rationally. But we are not. Because Facebook is not really giving what we want and what we choose. Because we don't know exactly how does this choice happens. Because the algorithm is actually not public. So we cannot scrutinize. And we still keep doing it and using it, although it's damaging our emotional sense. Because we are acting as emotional users. And Facebook is really making us prey to their design. So, as I said, this is because users often complain about the dryness of rationalized experience. There is a general lack of meaning from life coming from in our modern society. Everything is rationalized. So education is rationalized. Our work is rationalized. Now, even our everyday life at home is rationalized through all these appliances, all these schedule needs, because we have these frenetic lifestyles. And we feel bored. We feel bored. We don't really get meaning from repeating the same thing all over every day in the same way. With no new things, no surprise, no challenges, no going out of the comfort zone. And that's in the context where Facebook and other apps that tries to manage your emotions, they breed. Well, Facebook tells a story, man, that they are trying to make the world happy. That's their mission. So they really admit they are in this emotional business. But they are not, I wouldn't say, telling a good story. Bye-bye. We'll talk later. So they're not really telling a good story, I would say, because nobody believes in that. But Apple, a lot of people believe in the story of Apple. A lot of people believe that Apple really started from a garage place, and Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, they joined forces, they created this revolutionary company that really tried to foresee the future, and they did cool things like artists. And artists should use Apple because we need a revolution in the computers, and we need more artists using computers. So they run this campaign, Think Different, which I think is really thoughtful. They associated using computers, and Apple computers especially, with some great thinkers that really revolutionized our world. So they wanted to say that we are also in the same business of revolutions. That's what Apple had to tell. And it's not like since then, because before this campaign, they were already recognized for doing such things. And they're still somehow having this aura of innovative company. Nowadays, they don't talk about revolution any longer, but because if they wanted to revolutionize, they would have to revolutionize themselves, because they are the biggest ones now. And in the past, in the Think Different campaign, they were small compared to Microsoft, IBM, and other companies. Nowadays, they are bigger. Well, Apple used design a lot, employed to tell stories. And how does design tell stories? Stimulating the senses in a meaningful way. And sometimes stimulating one sense to stimulate indirectly another sense. So that's called synesthesia. It's a very old resource we use in design. And especially in color theory, there's a lot of thought on synesthesia. How can you convey emotions and feelings and touch through colors? But sometimes stories, they might not be authentic. And you design a very beautiful craft for your story, but people don't believe in it. Like the Facebook story, or like Shell Make Future story. Shell build up a campaign telling that they are really worried about the future of our world and they are doing everything they can to avoid having an unsustainable world, but they deny that climate change exists. So it's not really authentic, right? And people really hated this campaign, and in the social networks it backfired. So let's come back to design and understand what it is, and especially how do you conceive design in a way that is useful to deal with this experience challenge. If you Google design again, you will see a lot of models, like diagrams we saw before, but mostly you will see products. You will see the result of design activity, and especially featuring the form factor of these products. And that's not what the design we're talking about, of course. A good definition of design for this situation is given by Professor Klaus Krippendorf. He wrote a book about the semantic turn, and he's talking about how design is now more concerned with meaning than it was in the past. Once it was concerned with information. And there's a big difference between information and meaning. But anyhow, the definition, the simple definition he provides is design is making sense of things. And before we proceed on this presentation, I'm gonna challenge you for a quick experience. Would you like to go through it now? All right. So, let's see how design makes sense of things. We're gonna dig into this definition of design in a practical way. So, design makes sense of things, spaces, and activities. Broadly speaking, right? I'm trying to basically talk about all kinds of designs here. And how does it do that? So, manipulation, transformation, articulation, whoever you want to talk about, form, function, and structure. Let's exaggerate to see how this works. So, these examples that follows, they are really trying to show one of these sites, form, function, structure, where it is more important for that object. But most of the projects in design, they have to have a balance and not be just about form or just about structure or just about function. But take, for example, decorative craftwork. It has no usefulness. It's basically the only thing you can do is decorate, nothing else. It's just useless stuff. But it looks pretty. So form gives you meaning much more than the structure and the function of those objects. So here's how design makes sense of things. Design gives this shape to plush, and plush looks like an animal. And the animal is cute, so you decorate your home with that. Now, let's look at an example where structure provides you meaning. In Brazil, there is a common ritual. After cleaning your kitchen, you finish up cleaning the stove and you close the lid, the top of the stove, and you put something nice on top of the cover. For example, a nice embroidered textile, or you put some fruits on top of it. That means you are done with cleaning and your kitchen is clean. And everybody else that goes into your kitchen knows that, because this is a cultural code. And in Brazil, they try to get rid of those stove lids, and the consumer said, no, we want them because they are not very useful. You can do many things with that. and they don't have much function, but they have a structure that allows this ritual. The structure is, it changes from being just something on top of it, from being something that you can close and show to other, symbolize to other people that you are done. And the third example is an example where function plays a big role for meaning. So what is the meaning of a key if not opening a door? The shape of the key, the structure of the key, the shape is just weird. And but the shape helps, there's a function for the shape on the that it identifies the special door you have to open. So the function really provides you meaning. So those, remember, those are exaggerated examples, right? So let's have an experience where you're going to realize how design provides meaning to things through function. And you're gonna see how function has a lot of meaning. Most people would say that in design, function is not associated with meaning. People would associate meaning with form or with structure. But you can also do that with function. So, the alterity experience I'm proposing to you, you sit in pairs, or you can also sit in three people. I think it's more nice if you're three or four people, and you just share your keys, and you show, so here is my keys, and these keys I use to open that door and the place where I go. Then you tell a story about that place. And while you're doing this, you're probably learning a lot about the other person. And you go around. And it's good and better if you sit with people that you don't know here. So you will learn more about them. Alright? So we have 5 minutes for this experience. So guys, I guess you already noticed from this experience how deep meanings can be ascribed to such simple things such as key. And the question is, can you design the meaning? No, you can't design the meaning. But you can design the function of a key to be an anchor to that meaning. If the key does not work, then it has no meaning, right? So the function is crucial to a key. But that's all it is. Sometimes you put some other stuff in your keychain that has special form, that has a meaning, and that, but it's not about the function any longer because it's useless stuff. But it is just a meaningful stuff that brings you, that helps you to remember someone or somewhere, someplace.
Something that was very interesting in our group is the lack of too many keys is part of our characters and personalities. Mm. You know, some of us do not close their doors, so they don't carry that key.
Yeah. Wow!
Some of us only carry the car key. And yes, exactly. Some of us do not close their doors.
You mean some of us in this room?
Some of three of us.
You guys don't live in Brazil, right?
No. And some of us, you know, carry separate sets of keys. Like I have this, is a personal set of keys. That red one over there is this set of keys for this classroom. And I teach in other classrooms, which I keep the keys for. And I have a new set. So it's the way you use the simple key object is not so simple.
Yeah, definitely. That's my point. We build up a lot of meanings out of simple things. And you cannot control that. That's not the point of design once you want to make sense of things. Because people would also make sense of things. Well, now let's deal with spaces. So spaces also can be designed to convey meaning from with these three resources I'm talking about, form, structure, function. This first example is a place where form is all there is. It's an inflatable place called Architects of Air exhibition. I went there in the Netherlands. It's really a beautiful art installation, I would say. It's really incredible. You go inside this inflatable structure. It's huge. It's really huge. There are a lot of paths that you can follow inside. And you can just lie down there and enjoy being in a different world. It feels like you are inside a science fiction movie and in a distant land, distant planet. Yeah, but the thing is all about the form. So the form factor of the colors, the touch, it's very soft and gentle. All right, so this is an example where you cannot live in that place because there's no function and no structure for that. But you can enjoy the form. I stay there for 2 or 3 hours. This place, the gym, is the opposite of it. It's all about the function. You go to the gym to get fitter, fit, right? So you don't go to the gym to enjoy the place, right? And it's not enjoyable anyway. So you just go there, use the machine, then get out. So the function, and usually there is no structure to it. If you go to the gym, there's a whole bunch of machines, and it's not really organized. There's no, it could be organized, but most of the gyms are not, because people don't care so much about this. And even other places, structure might be more meaningful. For example, Jardim das Sensações, which is inside of Jardim Botânico. It's a nice place where you can have a different experience of being a garden, because the garden can be experienced using through touch, right? So you can borrow them from them. Covering, what's the name of this?
Blindfold.
What?
Blindfold,
right. So you can experience a blindfold. And there are some special plants with strong smells and special textures that you can feel. And this is all structure built into the place for you to experience that. So, let's see about the time. I don't think we have time for this. I would finish up, and if we have time enough, we go through this welcoming experience. So let's finish up this discussion about meaning with activities. So activities is another way of making sense, another object to make sense in design. Activity, when the form is more important than function and structure, you get activities that are formal. For example, board meeting, a board meeting, when everybody talks but nobody understands anything. People just say what they are saying all the time. Nothing gets decided. Nothing gets. You wouldn't imagine how many of those meetings we go through in this university, right, Kelly? Yeah. A meeting to schedule another meeting.
They have a whole week of it, right? It's called...
Yeah, planejamento e capacitação, exactly.
AI, it's true. There are more problems than resolving.
Yeah, yeah. But people don't notice that you could use this opportunity to solve the problems, but since they are you in a formal... approach, they would just say things and not get to the point. Sometimes they would avoid telling really what they want to tell because that would break the formality. Anyhow, it's a mess. I don't really like those things. I really like to make meetings productive through building stuff and drawing, and as we do in our class. But there's other activities, the function is more important than the structure and form. For example, street cleaning. Street cleaning, if you look at that, how it's done in Brazil, by the Garis. These guys, they do in the worst way possible. It's not ergonomic. They suffer a lot from back pains because they are using such an old technology. Those, what's the name again? The sweeper.
Broom. Yeah.
Broom. So they are using those brooms, and they are, doing that.
Sometimes they are not actual brooms. They are improvised brooms.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Leaves.
They have to build themselves, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And they are there doing their job very slowly. It's not efficient at all. But why does it exist? Why do you keep that if we have machines? And we do have. Even in Curitiba, we have some machines that clean our streets during the night. Well, I don't think they are used nowadays, but in the past we did have. And they were just cleaning like some big trucks with a special wearing stuff that would clean, like a big vacuum. But we keep the garis because there is a social function to this job. A lot of people are unemployed in Brazil, and especially, and also in Curitiba, and they need to have a job. So the state has to pay a job for them, which is useful for the state. Of course, cleaning the streets is useful, but in a least efficient way. So it's better for a society if these people are employed and doing an inefficient job than to fire them and put robots to clean the streets. That wouldn't be good for a society. Thousands of people that are currently employed will be unemployed. They might become criminals, or they might just lose their lives in some ways. Like, it's not a good result.
That's very good discussion. I used to work for IBM and sell equipment, and one of those equipments were automatic cashiers for supermarket, and I refused to sell them. I refused. I sold a lot of other things to supermarkets, but never the automatic cashiers. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, if you go to festival, they are making you work for them, just like Professor said before. Like, the user works for the company, now you work for festival because you wait,
you beep
your packets, and you pay, and you are taking the job of someone who really needs.
That's a good point. Yeah, self-service systems, they have this problem.
It makes me mad. That's why I interrupted.
Right. So we don't see these things in the Netherlands where I stayed. Everything is automated, but there is no lack of jobs for people. And people are highly educated, so they really can get other jobs. For example, operating those cleaning machines. But not in Brazil, so we still need to keep them. Well, the third example of an activity that can have meaning from its structure is morning routines, or any kind of routines. The routines, after you repeat so many times, it doesn't matter the function any longer. And it might even be dysfunctional. But you still do it. It might even do bad for your health. But you still keep doing it because that structure is somehow building up some special meaning to you that gives you confidence or gives you a state of mind that you need to do something else. So, for example, waking up and taking a shower, eating your breakfast, making up, choosing what to get, and people doing different orders. People build up their routines. If they can, right? If they are in a prison, they are bound to the routines of other the inmates, right? And that might have a meaning, but a bad one. So, how to design things, spaces, and activities in relation to each other. So the point is not to design meanings, but to design things, space and activities in relation so that they might have different kind of meanings. So to finish up my talk, my lecture, I would identify four approaches to integrate experience in design. We're gonna see these approaches unfold in practice in the next classes. The first one is linear, amazing, theatrical, and total. So let's start from the linear experience. This is based on the notion of a journey, that the user goes through a journey, much like a hero goes through a journey in a movie or in a story. And this journey, it's usually linear. So you must go through that, all the steps. And the hero journey, which is so well known and so used as a structure for movies and any other kind of stories, it's based on the call for action. That person is just a normal life, just a boring life. Then someone comes and calls him for an adventure. Then he first denies. Then he accepts the adventure call. Then he goes to develop his skills. Then at some point he dies or something challenges his life, and then he recovers and then becomes stronger. Then he has a final challenge against the big enemy and so on. And then he turns back to have a calm life again. And then the movie number two happens again. It's following the same structure. And we can do that in user experience design if you use customer journey maps, or if you use other kinds of diagrams that linearize the experience. As you saw, experience is very complex. There are multiple threads to it. But you can simplify and have a big picture over it if you put into a stepwise visualization. We're going to have a lot of exercises on doing customer journey maps, blueprints, and customer experience mapping, which are all based on this linearizing approach. And the idea is that the user goes through something which is predefined, which is not true for the experience, but it's just a helpful design resource for trying to cope with this complexity. Yes?
In this example, just by looking at the emoticons, you can see the areas where the user may not be, or the user is not satisfied at all sometimes. And those may be the points where the experience needs to be redesigned. Does it make sense?
I don't know. I can't really read anything.
I'm not reading anything.
Just through the emojis, I think they're actually going through phases of, I don't know if it's my personal experience, but like life events, realizations, seeking help, I think it's more about the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't even know what this example is about, and it's just an example.
Of
linearizing an experience that can be very deep. For example, talking about depression, and how do you go through depression? Well, every person has a different experience with depression, but if you linearize, you try to find what are the common steps. Definitely, you lose by doing that. But they also gain design overview. And you can also have multiple layers. Not just steps, but layers. And things happening in different layers. For example, you do something, and then someone else does something else. But a third person also does something. And each of these people are in a different layer. And some people are visible, some people are invisible. Amazing experience. This is the decision-making metaphor. So you see an experience as a series of decisions, like going through a maze, a labyrinth. So you have to choose. Anytime you are in a junction, for example, over here, you can choose going right or and being stuck, or going left and try to find a way out. or the way in, if you are interested on. So, how does this translate into design? You design multiple paths diagrams, like flowcharts. You can, in this example, you can do a lot of different things after interacting with a bank. For example, you can call the government and complain about the bank. But you can also call the bank and try to solve your problem. So they try to map all these different ways people can reach out the bank. And they didn't want to tell what is the best way to do or the common way to do. They wanted to map all the possibilities, all the main possibilities. So this is different than customer journey maps. And we're going to also do this kind of exercise. But the third and the one that I'm going to focus most in this course is the theatrical experience approach. The experience is considered like participating in a play. And for example, in the theater of the Prest place, sometimes people stop the play and ask, do you think that the character should react to this violence with the same equal violence? Or do you think that the character should just run away? Then people would raise their cards and they would count. And they would, the actors would act out what the audience decided. But sometimes they would invite the audience to join the play. And that some people are getting afraid sometimes. They don't sit on the first row in theater because they're afraid of being invited to participate. Because for these people, this is a not good experience. So, the best example of theatrical experience design is Disneyland, right? Everything over there is staged, and you might encounter a lot of people over there that just staff. They hire people to ride over there, just to show the example to real tourists real guests how they should ride, to create this kind of mass sensation of being in a crowd. But some people are just staff, actors, acting out as if they were guests. So everything is staged, like in theater. And this metaphor of theater is used in many ways in experience design. But the mostly visible way, and I'm just gonna to feature it, is the difference between front stage and backstage activities. Front stage activities can be seen by the customer, by the user. Backstage are not. They are preparations, they are executions of some orders, they are organizing parts there is no need for feedback or an input from the customer, the user. This idea of front stage, backstage, of course, is a metaphor borrowed from the way theater plays are organized. There's a lot going on in the backstage that you don't see because it's not part of the show. This is also used in experience design. Yes?
Just remember the story you told them last week. We went to a restaurant, and usually we only see the front stage, and everything is clean and nice, so the food is well presented. And in this particular restaurant we passed through the kitchen, and the kitchen was terrible. So the experience was kind of strange.
Yeah.
Because we got to see the backstage. It's not because we got to see the backstage, it's because the backstage was bad. Right? You don't...
It's not a bad thing per se, going through the backstage.
But just because it's supposed to be a backstage, it doesn't give you permission to make gambadas or things or that you should not
treating
do.
Badly your employees
treating
like
your employees in a badly manner.
So you hide, basically, right? It's not for hiding.
It's not for hiding.
It's for focusing on the experience. So you put everything that helps to contribute to the meaning of the situation in the front stage, and everything that would may not contribute or may show the reality behind it, you just put under the backstage. But if the customer or the user wants to see, the customer may be able to. But in a total experience design approach, you really hide it. You really hide it really well. And you create a sensation that there is nothing, there is no backstage. You deny it, basically. It's not just hiding, you deny. So you create a sense of reality, a new reality. Experience is the reality. What you are going through is not just created by man. This is more, almost like natural. That's the way things always went. They will be in the future. Virtual reality labs, like this one in university where I studied, they try to create this kind of total experience design. You go through in there and you can experience, for example, being in a desert through all the technologies they have over there, and simulating a desert, living in the desert for a while, just to have the experience. And this can also be done with bricks and mortar. For example, Frank Lloyd Wright, who was a famous architect from the United States, he designed a lot of buildings with really details to craft. Like, everything in the building was designed by himself. From the cutlery, like to the whole lot. And not just the house, but the whole lot and the garden and everything else was designed by the same person. Actually, he had a team, but everything was really having his own brand. He was really good on that. And that's why he's considered to be one of the greatest architects of all times. But this attention to details was also a kind of imposition on people's experiences. He would regularly visit people that lived in the places that he designed, and he would complain, "Why is this thing, this chair, not in the place where I said to be? Oh no, I thought this was more comfortable. No. Over there is the best way." And then he would tell a story about it, because he had a lot of philosophical reasons for why doing all this. But the worst example of total experience design is definitely what the Nazis did in Germany and in other places where they conquered. They had a total vision for society, a total vision for a citizen, and everything was designed. They really wanted to design the things that you use for in your everyday life, the things that you use in your social life, and the ideas that you spoke about. If you would talk about things that were not good for the national, for the Reich and so on, you would just get jailed, and it was forbidden. And there is this book, which is the best example of a visual identity guide. It's the most complete visual identity guide of human history. I think it's 1,000 pages or something like that. It's really huge, and it tells everything about them. How does a Nazi party society should be like? All the structure of the institutions, all the badges they would use, all the clothes in different situations, all the artwork, because this was considered artwork, and so on. It's really a detailed one. If anyone wants to take a look, I have a copy of that. But it's very sad and a good example of what not to do. So I'm not supporting total experience design. That's not what I think it's a good example of experience design, because it puts too much power on over a handful of people that can design that experience for masses. And they are not there to be accountable, hold accountable. So it looks like it came from some metaphysical place. It was not designed. This is natural. This is the way to be. We don't ask, we don't question that. And that might create alienation. So people don't know why the experiences they are going through are like that. They don't question and they just, well, they might not even live their lives. They are just some cogs in a machine. All right. So that was it for today's explanation. We still have some time for discussing the objects you brought, right? And the text you read. That's the proposal for now.